Now, on Surrealistic Pillow, which of course was a fantastic Jefferson Airplane album, there's a credit on the back of the album, Jerry Garcia, spiritual advisor.
Well,
how did that happen?
Well, we were going down and working with RCA. We'd already worked with RCA at one album, and it was sort of irritating. So we tried to hire Jerry, and he needed money at the time because, you know, they weren't popular at the time. And so we made RCA pay him some good amount of money to come down and just sort of be there and help focus us between us and the RCA hired producer and the powers that be, and contribute here and there and give us his advice, because Jerry was a very sweet, bright, advisable person, and he contributed greatly to it. He played on several of the songs. He said, do this, don't do that. And half the time we believed him, and half the time we said, go fuck yourself. And and it worked out very well, I think, for both of us. He made some money to pay for the rent on 710 Ashbury, and we got his contributions to that album. I think more than anybody, though, the person who helmed that album was Marty.
Oh, yeah.
That was Marty's height of power. He had the songs. He had the vision. We had to fire our first manager. He took over and directed that. We got Bill Graham. Marty was very focused in those years, and that was his album, really. Marty was responsible, for, I think, for both the two most popular Jefferson Airplane and Jefferson Starship albums, that and Red Octopus.
Oh yeah,
were Marty's shining highlights, I think.
Yeah.
And he made great contributions to both of those albums. And as such, both of those albums sold more than the rest of our other more strange, obtuse albums.
Yeah.
And well, so you got to give him credit and notice to that, because he was exceptional when he's on, he's exceptional.
Yeah.
He tends to drift, but so do I in another kind of science fiction mode, so I can appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I just figure, well, when Marty drifts, I'll fill in the holes, as I did on Baxter's, which is probably our worst-selling album.
Oh, it's a great album.
Oh, but it's our most adventurous.
Yeah.
And that's what I like to think I contribute to the band, is going beyond the pale to places where people are a little scared to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And pushing the rest of the band in those directions.
Yeah.
And so we, as a group, we all contributed, I think, to one another in a very healthy way for a good long time.
So you start having these other voices joining the Jefferson Airplane.
We've always had other voices.
Mm-hmm.
Garcia on Plastic Fantastic Lovers, Realistic Pillow.
Right.
Rhythm guitar, Jerry Garcia.
But at some point, there started to be a larger...
Coming Back to Me, Jerry Garcia. Beautiful song.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're beautiful. But at some point, for instance, an album like Blows or Sunfighter or Baron von Tolbooth started to become the product of really a community of musicians who somehow all suddenly had the time and the creative space.
We were all in the same spot at the same time, basically. Mm-hmm. We all collaborated on each other's albums.
Mm-hmm.
And the nexus point was Wally Heider Studios.
What was it about Wally Heider Studio and your lives at that point?
Quality of equipment.
Mm.
Wally was very high on good quality equipment and reproduction, tape recorders, mm-hmm. microphones, and all that. He was an L.A. guy.
Mm-hmm.
And like when the 60s happened, everybody in L.A. figured, well, we could cash in on this, from record companies to agents to the FBI, for that matter, and record studios. And they all came up here and built various studios. Columbia did, RCA did, Wally Heider's did. And Wally Heider's became the studio of choice because he did it right. Wally's had three studios, A, C, and D, amongst which any number of us would all be working at the same time, which was the critical point. I'd be making Blows in one studio. Garcia would be doing Something from the Dead down in D. Crosby would be up in C doing vocal overdubs. And as in movies, there's a lot of downtime, hurry up and wait kind of time, while they're setting up this, that, or the other thing. So we just aimlessly on drugs wandered into each other's studios and listen and saying, oh, I could add something to that.
Oh, yeah.
Give me a mic. And we go in and do something in the background. And Garcia would come in and play on a track. Harvey Brooks played bass on this. Crosby, Nash came in. Stills even. And Mickey Hart, Bill Kreutzmann. And all these people would just be wandering into each other's studios in the downtime. And it was just a very natural thing that happened. It wasn't planned.
Yeah.
It just occurred.
Yeah, yeah.
And we took advantage of that more than anything all the way through the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
That little community existed, and we'd Mickey's, what was that album? David's, Thunder. Rolling Thunder, Crosby's, If I Could Only Remember My Name.
Yeah.
Everybody was sort of, it was very incestuous, intermingling of musical variations that was, I think, very healthy. And made for some great music.
Yeah, you had quite a bit of input on David's album.
Oh, I was overwhelmed by the input on Blows.
Yeah.
And it eventually, that's why it became its own thing, because everything was just so tasty.
Yeah.
Garcia particularly. I was trying to mix side two, the space side, for like 3 weeks. And I am the worst mixer in the world. I'm like mathematically challenged. And 3/4 of mixing is mathematics. You got to know the board and 10 dBs at 2,000 cycles and all that kind of shit. And I can barely make it through algebra one, not to mention geometry, algebra two. And so I was struggling for weeks and pasting together. And then Graham Nash comes in, who was a master at mixing. And he listens. Yeah, I could do that, he says. And I said, you could do what? Well, I could mix that and make it sound really good. And I said, oh, really? I will go ahead.
Graham actually told me he had a little lysergic help on that mix.
Well, whatever. But more to the point, he had the chops.
Yeah.
With the board.
Yeah.
And he knew how to manipulate that. I still, every time I've given up, finally, I've learned that this is not my area. And even if somebody else mixes it half bad, it's about 10 times better than I could do.
Yeah.
So I tried for years to mix and get all the ideas that I wanted to into the mix. But it always fucked up the sound because I didn't want to hear everything. Right. Like Jack's 12 tracks on Sunrise. Yeah.
One of the things that's amazing about this album and the mix is that there are a lot of what you might call, well, non-traditional sounds in it. There are gongs, there's Jerry Garcia doing his Insect Fear guitar.
Yes.
And then there's that whole little piece called XM. Was that named after a science fiction movie called Rocket Ship XM?
Very good. Yeah, that was one of my first movies that I watched when I was a child.
That
moved me. It was Rocket Ship XM.
Oh, that's great.
It was like a trip. And that and Destination Moon. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah.
My father took me to New York and they had the premiere of Destination Moon in New York in some theater, and there was a guy walking around in a space suit out front in spotlights. So I was really, and they're really cheesy, bad movies.
Yeah.
But the concept of going beyond was inherent in both of those movies. Combine that and the Weavers, and you get my contribution to Jefferson Airplane. And the third part of my contribution was I was the only guy in the office taking care of details, saying where we play, what speakers we have, what kind of ticket sales, how much tickets cost, and what hotels we stay in. No, windows have to open, although that's later, actually. But things like that, I figured that was my section. Since I wasn't as good a player as Jack, Yorma, Spencer, Grace, or Marty, I figured this could be my contribution, is trying to take care of business so that we were all in a semi-healthy, civilized kind of a mode to run.
Well, there was also your voice, and particularly
now, I have a shitty voice compared to Grace and Marty. I'm an amateur. Come on.
Yeah, but
they are artists.
But when you guys are all singing together,
I have a nice
and very powerful
quality,
almost like a human chorus.
Yeah, but I'm like a guy singing in the shower, really. I'm not like an artist, singer-wise. You know. My main strength, I think, is songwriting. Very obtuse, sometimes abstract, otherworldly songwriting. And not popular at all. Like, I don't think I've ever had a pop single. Closest I got was Ride the Tiger and Volunteers.
Oh, yeah.
And they were too abstract for singles radio. I made like number 32 on the charts or something.
But
singles, like Pete Seeger, are not my forte.
Right.
And,
but nobody else made albums like this. I mean, the Second Side of Blows is a suite that has a orchestration and ambition that
was only by accident. Unusual. Only by accident.
How did that come together? How did the
well, like I said, it was two songs for a demo for the Airplane album,
yeah,
which was Hijack and Starship. Two simple songs. Starship really is Volunteers.
Yeah.
Turned around.
Yeah.
And psychedelicized and science fiction. Yeah. Hijack, I got from an old blues record. It's me being black.
Hilarious.
It's Paul Kant. Paul Kant. You know, I don't remember the song I stole it from, but that lick that goes boom, 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 it's some old blues song.
together, an offering to the sun in the name of the weather. I'm gonna hijack the
Crown of Creation is an old blues shuffle.
Oh, wow.
If you look deep, heart and hard enough. I steal from everybody. Any good songwriter does. The secret to being a good songwriter, I think, is stealing and changing it enough so that you're not obviously stealing.
Yeah, yeah.
And adding to it the thing that your band or you or whatever is to make it unique. That's the beauty of what Pete Seeger calls the folk process.
Yeah, yeah.
Beethoven stole from the peasants who lived around his castle or,
oh, yeah,
or wherever and adapted these great melodies to something else.